Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 11, the Ursuline Convent Riots. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. And this week is part one of our inauguration special. We'll be talking about the 1834 riot in Charlestown that resulted in the destruction of a Catholic school, the rampant anti-Catholic prejudice that led to the riot, and the travesty of justice that allowed the perpetrators to walk free. But first, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is January 9th, which is the anniversary of John F. Kennedy's City Upon a Hill address. It was 10 days before his presidential inauguration, and he addressed the Massachusetts legislature, explaining how the values of the Bay State would guide his administration.
So it is that I carry with me from this state to that high and lonely office to which I now succeed more than fond memories or firm friendships. The enduring quality of Massachusetts, the common threads woven by the Pilgrim and the Puritan, the fisherman and the farmer, the Yankee and the immigrant, will not be and could not be forgotten in this nation's executive mansion. They are an indelible part of my life, my convictions, my view of the past, and my hopes for the future. I have been guided by the standard John Winthrop set before his shipmates on the flagship Arabella 331 years ago, as they too faced the task of building a new government on a perilous frontier. We must always consider, he said, that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all peoples are upon us.
We'll have a link to the full recording of the speech and a transcript in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/011.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the founding of Chelsea. The territory was previously a part of Boston, but the area called Winnisimmett, Rumney Marsh, and Pullen Point was portioned off to become Chelsea on January 10, 1739. On January 11, 1798, the Massachusetts Sacred Cod moved up Beacon Hill in a solemn procession. The new state house was opening, and the symbol of the Massachusetts House of Representatives was being ceremoniously moved from the old state house on State Street to the new, domed building that had been built in one of John Hancock's pastures on Beacon Hill.
Thursday, we mark the birthday of three famous Johns. John Winthrop, leader of the Arbella fleet of Puritan immigrants and founder of Boston, was born on January 12, 1588. John Hancock, the Patriot firebrand, first signer of the Declaration of Independence, and governor of Massachusetts, was born in Boston on January 12, 1737. And artist John Singer Sargent was born on January 12, 1856. The painter was mostly known as a portraitist, but he created three great murals, all of which are in the Boston area. The Rotunda of the MFA, the entry to Harvard's Widener Library, and his masterwork, The Triumph of Religion, at Boston Public Library in Copley Square.
Boston's favorite tourist hotspot, Faneuil Hall, was burned to the bare brick walls by a fire on January 13, 1761. The colony held a lottery to raise money to repair it, and it was renovated, expanded, and reopened the following year. It was further expanded by architect Charles Bulfinch in 1806. Even by the early 19th century, it was recognized as an enduring landmark, with the Marquis de Lafayette commenting during his visit to Boston in 1824, "May Faneuil Hall ever stand, a monument to teach the world that resistance to oppression is a duty."
Massachusetts held a day of prayer and fasting on January 14, 1697, to try to atone for the Salem witch trials, during which a Boston congregation heard this statement of apology from witch trial judge Samuel Sewell. "As to the guilt contracted upon the opening of the late commission of Oyer and Terminer at Salem, to which the order for this day relates, he is, upon many accounts, more concerned than any that he knows of, desires to take the blame and shame of it, asking pardon of men, and especially desiring prayers that God not visit the sin of him, or of any other, upon himself, or any of his, nor upon the land." For a great history of the Salem witch trials, check out Season 1 of the Witch Hunt Podcast at witchhuntpodcast.com.
Finally, Sunday is January 15th, and on January 15th, 1919, a great wave of molasses crashed into the North End, destroying buildings and killing 21 people and untold numbers of horses and mules. For a complete retelling of the Great Molasses Flood, check out Episode 3 at hubhistory.com/003.
This week, though, is the first of a two-part series of shows about Boston's changing demographics in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the ugly reactions locals displayed in return. With the presidential inauguration coming up next week, this theme seems more topical than ever. We're not saying we're talking about Trump, but we're talking about Trump. From where we sit in Boston in 2017, it's hard to imagine what Boston was like prior to 1845. We're such an Irish-identified city today. Every bar is an Irish pub. We have shamrocks on our Red Sox hats. But that Irish identity is something that started rather late in Boston history, after the potato famine in Ireland in 1845. Up until that point, Boston had been a very homogenous society. It was a city that shared a strong Yankee identity, one that was English-descended, and one that was almost universally Protestant. When Irish immigration began in earnest in 1845, it was like a population bomb in Boston. By the time of the 1850 census, first and second generation Irish American immigrants made up about 60,000 of about 130,000 total Boston residents. That's almost half the population in the first 5 years. But before large-scale immigration began, Irish Americans were a tiny sliver of the Boston area population. And those that were here were looked at by Yankees with a lot of distrust and disdain. Remember that most Irish American immigrants at that time were Roman Catholic, and New England, and Boston in particular, had a deep-seated bias against Catholics.
A deep-seated bias against somebody who doesn't share the same religion as you. This sounds very familiar.
You can hear more about the roots of New England's anti-Catholic bias in our show Remember, Remember, the 5th of November, our very first episode at hubhistory.com/001. By the time our story takes place, that prejudice went back centuries, back to England, and back to the European Wars of Religion in the 16th and 17th centuries. It was only made worse by the English Civil War, which took place in the 1640s, well after Boston was founded.
Our story opens at an Ursuline convent near Boston in 1834. The Ursulines are a religious order in the Catholic Church dedicated solely to the education of girls. They were founded in 1535 by Angela Merici, who was later sainted. Originally, she envisioned a group of women who lived amongst the communities they served without any special distinctions like wearing the habit. However, after Merici's death, the church hierarchy was uncomfortable with the idea of women with that amount of power and autonomy. By 1572, the order had agreed to reinvent itself as a cloistered order, living in convents with strict vows. The Ursuline order was the first group of nuns to arrive in North America. The first group set up a school in Quebec in 1639. Then another group came to New Orleans in 1727. Their school in New Orleans is now considered the oldest surviving building in the entire Mississippi Valley. Jake and I were able to visit when we were in Louisiana a few years ago, so we'll post pictures of the altar and some of the statues on the grounds in the show notes for this week's episode. While priests were banned from early Massachusetts on pain of death, Catholicism becomes officially tolerated with the Massachusetts Constitution in 1780. As Boston slowly becomes more hospitable to Catholics, the official diocese is founded in 1808. Pretty soon thereafter, an order of Ursuline nuns was established in Boston in 1820. Ironically, it seems that most of their students were Protestant children. According to one source, there were 47 girls enrolled in the Ursuline Secondary School in 1834, only six of whom were Catholic. With so few good options for educating girls at that time, many of the upper-class Protestant families who could afford it sent their daughters to be taught by the Ursulines. Their convent was originally located on Franklin Street at Downtown Crossing, but within a few years, they were getting too successful and the convent was bursting at the seams. And when they relocated, they went outside the city of Boston.
It's actually a little bit convoluted to describe where the Ursuline convent ended up moving to. They moved to a place called Mount Benedict in Charlestown. Seems simple enough, right? But that part of Charlestown, is now known as East Somerville, after Somerville became an independent town in 1842. And Mount Benedict was known for decades as Plowed Hill. It was the site of skirmishes during the Revolution. At first, it was the no-man's land between British-held Charlestown and the Patriot defenses around Prospect Hill. One night in August 1775, the rebels pushed their lines forward and took over the hill, incorporating it into their defenses. As far as I can tell, the name was only changed to Mount Benedict at the time the Ursulines moved there in 1827. But if you're looking around East Somerville today, don't count on finding Mount Benedict. You'll see St. Benedict Parish Church, you'll see Benedict Street, you'll see Benedict Avenue, but not Mount Benedict. Like Fort Hill in Boston, and like the top 60 feet or so of Beacon Hill for that matter, most of Mount Benedict was cut down in the late 19th century and used to fill in the salt marshes where the Assembly Square Mall is today. So where should you look for evidence of Mount Benedict? Well, we'll post an 1852 map of Somerville in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/011. You'll see Mount Benedict on the map, and the ruins of the Ursuline Convent are marked. If you compare that to a modern map of Somerville, you can see a triangle made by McGrath Highway, I-93, and Broadway, which is just across the highway from the Assembly Square Home Depot, and that is where the Ursulines built their second convent in 1827. They built a grand campus on the hill they called Mount Benedict. A former student would later describe that, quote, "Nearly the whole of Mount Benedict was enclosed for the use of the convent. There was a lodge, a bishop's house, several terraced walks, and grounds tastefully laid out for the recreation of the pupils. No such elegant and imposing building had ever been erected in New England for the education of girls. Picturesque on the summit of the hill, its many-windowed facade, glowing in the light of the setting sun, was a sightly object to the good citizens of Boston returning from their afternoon drive in the suburbs."
Rumors swirled around Boston and Charlestown about the strange rituals and terrible abuse suffered behind the walls of this grand campus. Building on the inherent biases of Yankee Bostonians, people began to murmur that the nuns were held captive as forced labor, that children were terribly abused and baptized into the Catholic Church against their will and the desires of their parents. And always, in the background, there was a subtle implication of lesbian sexual abuse. A woman named Elizabeth Harrison was the spark that lit the powder keg in our story. She was a music teacher and a 13-year veteran of the Ursuline Order, practicing under the religious name Sister Mary John. On the night of July 28, 1834, she left the convent and visited a local family. Some sources say it was the family of a student, while others say she surprised a family in a house chosen at random. She was out of sorts, bedraggled, and possibly incoherent. Maybe it was a crisis of faith, and maybe it was a bit of a breakdown brought on by the workload of a young teacher. Either way, the next morning, a bishop and the Mother Superior arrived and convinced her to return to the convent, explaining away her condition as a brain fever. Anti-Catholic activists had a field day with the story, saying that she was being held against her will and tortured at the convent. As the story spread through the surrounding community, it seems to have gotten jumbled together with the fantastical tales of abuse told by another young woman a few years earlier. So the community quickly became convinced that the convent was a depraved place, holding children and women captive and subject to terrible abuse. Less than 2 weeks later, placards appeared all over Boston on Sunday morning, August 10th, saying, "To the selectmen of Charlestown, gentlemen, it is currently reported that a mysterious affair has lately happened at the nunnery in Charlestown. Now it is your duty, gentlemen, to have this affair investigated immediately. If not, the truckmen of Boston will demolish the nunnery Thursday night, August 14th.
Taking the warning to heart, a delegation from the Charlestown selectmen went to the convent to investigate on August 11th. They were admitted by the Mother Superior, and they interviewed Sister Mary John. She testified that she was free to leave at any time, but happy where she was. The committee found no evidence of torture, white slavery, or sexual abuse, and left satisfied. The selectmen planned to write an editorial for the next day's paper, but in the meantime, a mob was forming around the convent that night. A crowd of dozens of agitators gathered outside the gates, lighting bonfires, and shouting angrily for the imprisoned nuns to be released. As the crowd grew angry and noisy, they were joined by hundreds more, community members and curious passersby. Nuns came to the windows to proclaim that they didn't need rescue, but the protesters paid them no mind. At one point, the Mother Superior seems to have really stirred up the crowd by shouting angrily, "The bishop has 20,000 of the vilest Irishmen at his command, and you may read your riot act till your throats are sore, but you'll not quell them." That was the straw that broke the camel's back. The rioters broke down the gates, charged up the hill, and kicked in the doors and windows of the convent building. As the nuns and their students fled out a back door and hid in the surrounding gardens and orchards, the rioters began trashing the building, setting fires, desecrating the altar, and even breaking open tombs. A man named John Bazell, who was one of the ringleaders, later testified, "The first thing that was done after getting in was to throw the pianos, of which 9 were found, out of the windows. The mob crowded in such numbers that it was with great difficulty that I got upstairs to the chapel, which was located on the 2nd floor. When I finally succeeded in forcing my way into the chapel, I found a fire about the size of a bushel basket blazing merrily in the middle of the floor. It was made of paper, old books, and such other inflammable stuff as they could lay their hands on, and soon spread in all directions. When the main building was enveloped in flames, we went to look for the cookhouse and ice house, which were separate buildings, and set them on fire." At a little distance from the main building stood what was called the Bishop's Lodge, where he had a library, and where he used to keep his robes and etc. After the ice house was fired, I started for this lodge and was the first to get in. I picked up a heavy desk and was giving it a swing to heave it out of the window when the mob arrived and, not knowing I was within, smashed the glass. The broken pieces were thrown violently into my face, cutting many bad gashes from which the blood flowed freely. However, I wiped my face and, getting out the bishop's robe, put it on in a spirit of deviltry. The others stripped it off my back and, winding the remnants around poles, used them as torches, lighting them at the main building and firing the lodge with them. The farmhouse and barn were burned next, after which the tomb was visited to see if the body of the music teacher Mary St. John was there. The door of the tomb was broken open, and within was the body of a young girl who had evidently been dead but a day or two at most, and whom I religiously believe to this day to have been Mary St. John, although I had no positive proof of her identity. This finished the events on the hill, and after watching the flames for a while, the immense mob slowly dispersed. We'll have a link to the transcript of Bazell's trial before the Mass SJC in the show notes for this week's episode. As the fire set by Bazell and his friends swept through the campus, local fire departments arrived on the scene but did nothing to fight the blaze. Were they sympathetic to the rioters? Did some of the Yankee firefighters even join the melee? Or were they simply afraid that they'd be hurt, either deliberately by angry rioters or accidentally by the flying glass shards, furniture, and incendiaries being thrown from the building? Either way, the next morning the convent campus lay in ruins. While the mayor of Boston called a town meeting at Faneuil Hall to discuss a response, and Bishop Fenwick called a meeting of the Catholic citizens to warn them against any retaliation, a mob of thousands paraded through the streets of Boston. They tried to get to Faneuil Hall, then they tried to pull down the Catholic Church in Boston. After being thwarted both times by armed militia, the frustrated mob returned to the smoldering ruins of the Ursuline Convent on the night of August 12th, and they rampaged through them again, burning fences, fruit trees, and anything else they could get their hands on. A third night of violence was only prevented by posting the militia within Boston and raising the drawbridge that connected Boston and Charlestown.
In the days and weeks after the riot, everyone in the community knew who had been involved. It's not as if anyone was wearing masks, and it's not as if there was any reason to hide your involvement. In the end, 13 men were arrested and 8 of them were charged with arson and burglary, both of which were punishable by death in 1834. Among the 8 was John Bazell, who we quoted above giving self-incriminating testimony. Despite their own statements, despite eyewitness testimony, despite all of the evidence against them, all but one of the defendants was acquitted. The court at times questioned whether the sworn testimony of a Catholic could be trusted, saying that their oaths held less weight. Some of the judges went as far as allowing the defense to turn the trials into attacks on the Catholic Church itself, and almost all of the juries were packed with Yankees who were predisposed to disdain Catholicism. Sister Mary John testified against Bazell. In fact, she remains in the Ursuline convent order for the rest of her life, so apparently she wasn't being held against her will at all. And after the riot in Boston, she transferred to the convent in Quebec where she lived out her days. It would seem that the truth was irrelevant. Despite her efforts, Bazell was found not guilty, receiving thunders of applause by the audience in the courtroom, then the congratulations of thousands of his overjoyed fellow citizens on the streets outside. Only one person was convicted of any crime resulting from the riot. 16-year-old Martin Massey was convicted of arson for burning the bishop's books and given a life sentence. The governor pardoned him before he had served a day.
You'd think that Massachusetts would have learned a lesson in religious tolerance from this embarrassment, but our history of anti-Catholic bias was far from over. After the pace of Irish immigration increased in 1845, an ugly nativist political party called the Know-Nothings was formed. It campaigned on a platform of opposing immigration and trying to minimize Catholic influence on American culture.
This is another part of the story that also sounds very familiar. Also, the irony of being called the Know-Nothings Party.
This wasn't even the last time that Protestant Yankees and Irish Catholics clashed violently in the streets of Boston. The 1837 Broad Street Riot was largely a sectarian clash, sparked after Yankee firefighters attacked an Irish Catholic funeral procession. And the 1863 draft riots in the North End began when Irish Americans believed they were being unfairly singled out for the draft, and ended with Yankee militiamen firing a cannon at a crowd of civilians, killing several people, including a 12-year-old boy. You can bet that we'll examine both those riots in more detail in future episodes. Even the Back Bay Project held the seeds of anti-Catholicism. The city decided to fill in the salt marsh in the Back Bay to create a grand new neighborhood, in part because so many Irish Americans were making their homes in older Boston neighborhoods. And while the city gave Protestant churches prime pieces of real estate for free, only St. Cecilia managed to get a Catholic foot in the Back Bay door. It was on the very fringe of the neighborhood and only allowed to exist so that the Irish domestic servants in the new neighborhood wouldn't have to be absent for too long to go to Mass. The hulking ruins of the Ursuline convent itself remained in view for decades. The top of Mount Benedict had a great view of Boston, and it became a popular picnic spot. Can you imagine how tasteless it would be to have a picnic in the shadow of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham? Yet, Bostonians seem to have no qualms about doing the same in Charlestown. Only in 1875, when the Boston Diocese was building the new Cathedral of the Holy Cross, were the ruins finally removed. The remaining bricks and stones were incorporated into the new church in the South End, bringing some sense of closure to Boston's Catholic community. Since then, it's helped to bring a sense of closure to all of Boston, as the site chosen for President Obama's moving speech following the 2013 marathon bombing.
In the show notes this week, we're going to post an 1845 romance novel that reimagines the riot through the eyes of an outraged Protestant. It treats the actual riot as cover for the fictional rescue of a damsel in distress. A dashing sailor, his friend, and his friend's Muslim bride arrange the riot as a distraction while they liberate his fiancée, who is being tortured and held against her will in the Ursuline convent. This is disappointing, because a decade later, it is still playing on the exact same fears and rumors that sparked the riot in the first place, repeating statements that had been proven time and again to be lies.
Again, we're not saying we're talking about Trump, but we're talking about Trump.
We'll post pictures of the Ursuline convent before, during, and after the riot. And we'll have a link to the completely ineffectual report on the riot that the city council produced while the perpetrators were still marching in the streets.
Hey, guess what we have this week?
What's that?
Listener feedback. It's been a while.
Ah, my favorite. Reverend Peter Preble, I hope I'm saying your name right, listened to episode 3 and said, "Great job by the Hub History folks on their podcast on the 1919 molasses flood in Boston." Tim Dempsey caught episode 10 on the brutal 1801 Fairbanks murder and wrote, "Sounds great. Just subscribed." And President John Adams must have heard us quote him in episode 5 when he tweeted from @SecondPotus. Thanks for the shout-out, Hub History. I am enjoying this podcast. Thank you, President Adams.
Well, John Adams also really got a kick out of our mention of the 2007 New Delhi monkey riots in episode 9, tweeting, "The New Delhi monkey riots. Come on. You got to know how to sell these babies. Seriously, though, everyone should listen." And he included a hilarious gif of Conan and Andy Richter. And genealogist and friend of the show Liz Loveland was feeling pretty down about the election results when she commented, "Nazis and anti-vaxxers, your podcast and tweets have almost become too topical."
If you, too, would like to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/hubhistory, and our Twitter handle is @hubhistory. You can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com or go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. We'd love to be able to read your feedback on the air. And while you're on there, be sure to click on subscribe to see all the ways that you can subscribe to the show. If you subscribe on iTunes, please consider reviewing us there. Your reviews will help other listeners find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with part 2 of our inauguration special about Sacco and Vanzetti and the anti-immigrant sentiment that sent an almost certainly innocent man to the electric chair at Charlestown Penitentiary.